Honest to Pete, as I sat down to write today my first draft, said, "Hey, Quiet Friday, huh?" From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. 19 May, Friday. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Honestly, I am not sure what to say at this point, except, man, there was more Russia White House Comey-related scoopage this afternoon from the Washington Post and the New York Times. However, comma, this is a show about business and economics, and that is where we are going to take it. Rachel Abrams is at the New York Times. Sudeep Reddy is at Politico. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
So, Sudeep, we talked about this the day that Jim Comey was fired. We got you on and we said, listen, what does this mean for the economic agenda of the Trump administration? And you said, I have no idea, except you said it better than that. Has the last, I don't even, what's it been, like 10 days changed anything? Are we still economically paralyzed agenda-wise?
We are mostly economically paralyzed. There was a lot of movement before the Comey firing that could have created the potential, the momentum for actually getting some small pieces of this done. The Comey firing and everything that's happened since then, and there's been a lot happening since then, it's all been a mind-bending series of political scandals, and we are just at the beginning of it. If it is this difficult to make sense of where we are now on all of these Russia scandals, I can promise you members of Congress who are trying to keep up are not necessarily digging in to figure out where to structure each piece of the tax code and how to put bonds in an infrastructure package and get all that done. It's just not going to be at the top of their minds right now.
And yet, Rachel, Speaker of the House Paul Ryan said today he was asked whether tax reform is going to get done in 2017. And he said, yes, yes, yes. Granted that he kind of has to say that, but reality check, please.
I think everything looks a little bit more dim in terms of chances, mm-hmm. just in light of all of the scandals enveloping the White House. And especially when you're talking about Paul Ryan, as we know, one of the things he cares about the most is this border adjustment tax. It just seems to be less and less likely, even and is even falling out of favor within his own party. And the border adjustment tax, of course, is this idea of taxing imports more heavily to encourage domestic production. And companies, retailers hate it. And it just seems like this thing that is, in some extent, one of Paul Ryan's babies is just mm-hmm. also seeming less and less likely.
Do me a favor and tell a tale out of school here. You and I were chatting and Sudeep before the gong went, right? And we were just checking the microphones and all this jazz. And you said, listen, I've been out reporting in not the Beltway and not New York City. And people are not paying as much attention as perhaps the rest of us. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. And, I was in a rural part of Pennsylvania, and the Comey news is just blaring in the background. It's lighting up my phone every 10 minutes. And people there, this is a former steel town I was in, and people there just, it wasn't, I talked to so many small business owners, you know, retail workers, local advocates, nonprofits, and what do you care about? What are you worried about? The answer is jobs, the economy, healthcare. And it's not Comey.
Sudeep, give me the so there's the president as we speak is on a plane to Saudi Arabia. There is this old trope in Washington that politics ends at the water's edge, right? When the president travels overseas. What about economics and our, this is a clunky way to put it, but American reputational brand value as he heads into negotiations with foreign leaders and as he is overseas as the commander in chief and the president?
If the last 4 months have taught us anything, it's that all rules, customs, and norms no longer exist in how we engage in economic diplomacy, security diplomacy, just about every front in engaging with all these countries. Just the things we've heard allegedly said in the Oval Office in engaging with Russia are enough to make your head spin. So if you were trying to build a sense of what's going to happen on the president's first foreign trip based on what often happens on a presidential foreign trip, you're looking at it the wrong way. There is a desire to get deals done and the desire to win. Everything else is really up for grabs. And so you will have the administration going into this and countries prepared for this, that the United States had been the driving force for globalism for decades, and now it is a leading force for nationalism, and people just don't know what to make of that right now.
Rich, let me bring it back home for a second and real quick talk the markets, just because there was that big sell-off on Wednesday and everybody's like, yeah, so what? How come Wall Street is not more antsy?
I don't know. I would imagine that Wall Street is still anticipating some business-friendly tax cuts. I think that, you know, there's still some optimism that Trump is going to revitalize the economy through tax cuts or other sorts of – there's still an optimism, basically. And I think you're seeing that reflected in the stock market to some extent. But obviously, consumers are not feeling confident. They're not spending more. And I think that is a source of is an issue right now.
Rich Labrams at the New York Times. Sudeep Reddy, he is with Politico. It's another Friday in this economy. Thanks, you two.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kai.
As I said on Wall Street today, the slightest hiccup as the Times and the Post let fly with their news this afternoon. But really, for traders today, like Wednesday never, ever happened. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. So as we talked about, Sudeep and Rachel and I, President Trump is going to land in Saudi Arabia in like 10 or 12 hours, bringing with him, figuratively to be sure, a $100 billion deal in which the Saudis are going to buy American-made planes and ships and munitions. And the Saudis aren't the only country in the region where American military contractors find eager customers. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has more now on the delicate balance between arms deals and diplomacy.
The Middle East is one of the biggest foreign markets for U.S. defense contractors.
They buy a lot of airplanes. They also buy a lot of tanks and armored vehicles.
Brian Clark is a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. He says the U.S. defense industry sells tens of billions of dollars worth of weapons internationally each year, with several caveats.
So with Bahrain and you know some of the Gulf countries, there's a concern that if we sell these countries' arms, they might use them against their own people in an effort to quell dissent.
Clark says U.S. arms exports have to be approved by the Pentagon, federal agencies like the State Department, and Congress, with U.S. defense contractors lobbying for the sales. Sometimes members of Congress with weapons plants in their districts weigh in, too. And here's something else. Once other countries buy U.S. weapons, they're hooked. Like the average consumer, they stick with brands they know, says Todd Harrison of the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
If you're an iPhone user, you're much more likely to buy the next version of an iPhone rather than switch to an Android phone. And so that's one way we keep them coming back.
And Harrison says if the U.S. doesn't sell weapons to a certain country, other manufacturers in, say, Russia or China will. Paul Shari is a senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security. He says there's a delicate balance here.
Human rights, U.S. military competitiveness, defense industry are all major factors, and a lot of them weigh in competing ways. And so the government has to be able to find a solution that balances them as best you can.
Even if sometimes that means losing out on a sale. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
You know how people make that lame joke about how this innovation or that is the Uber for whatever slice of the service economy is being discussed? How about Uber for trucking? Except this time it actually is Uber for trucking. Uber Freight wants to connect free agent truck drivers and small trucking companies with commercial shipments of pretty much anything and thus take a slice of the more than $700 billion trucking industry. Marketplace's Annie Baxter has that one.
Big trucking companies work with big brokerage companies. They're middlemen who use fancy technology to match loads with drivers. But smaller players, and there are a lot of them, often don't have access to those services.
There's 1.5 million drivers out there. About 30% or about a third of the capacity is with carriers that have 10 or fewer trucks.
Bill Driegert is the director of Uber Freight. He says those smaller players don't like haggling with brokers on the phone.
They know it's going to be stressful and like high touch, and they've got to go back and forth, and they don't feel like they always win out.
Enter Uber Freight, which, using dynamic pricing, connects drivers to shippers through an app. The drivers have to meet lots of criteria, like having the right kinds of insurance and safety ratings. Deborah Lockridge is editor-in-chief at Heavy Duty Trucking Magazine. She says, sure, Uber's been good at getting people from point A to point B, but she wonders if Uber Freight is ready to handle the complexity of trucking.
What happens if the load gets there? Maybe it's a refrigerated load, and part of those strawberries weren't kept at the right temperature and they're no good and the shipper rejects them.
Or what if truckers have to wait hours to deliver a load because the facility isn't ready to receive them? Kevin Hummer is skeptical Uber Freight can fix that common frustration. He's an owner-operator based in Wisconsin.
The receivers and the shippers are not going to all just, you know, do cartwheels just because Uber's getting in the game.
Still, Hummert says if Uber can charge less than current freight brokers, could be good. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey Circus is calling it quits after a final show on Sunday. There's a whole lot of reasons. Not as many people buying tickets these days. Circuses are expensive. And Ringling Brothers has been under huge amounts of pressure from animal rights activists. People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, PETA as it's known, was ecstatic at the news. They've been protesting the greatest show on earth for more than 30 years now. So with the big circus taken care of, the group's got the time and the money to turn up the heat on other parts of the entertainment industry, including Hollywood. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has our story.
Ladies and gentlemen.
For PETA, the ringmaster's last turn under the lights marks a profound shift.
I think it's an indication, really, of the fact that people now see using and abusing animals for entertainment is really a throwback to a much less enlightened time.
Lisa Lange is a senior vice president at PETA. She says the group will continue to take on SeaWorld. It'll fight other circuses, roadside zoos, and
we have an entire campaign that's dedicated to animals used and abused in film and television.
PETA spends millions of dollars each year organizing grassroots campaigns against animal abuse. When it comes to animals on film, it takes a hard stand. There should be no animal actors, period.
You know, the problem is that when animals are used, corners are cut because time is money. Anyone who's been on, you know, a Hollywood production knows that they've got to move really quickly.
Hollywood has had a very long and very rough history with animals.
That's Gary Baum, a senior writer at The Hollywood Reporter. He's done extensive investigative reporting on animal abuse in the industry.
It dates back to old westerns. It goes through war films.
Take the 1939 film Jesse James.
We gotta keep going, son. Hold on.
A horse was sent careening over a cliff into water below. It died, and it caused outrage. That's when the American Humane Association got involved in filmmaking. It's behind those "no animals were harmed" tags you might have seen at the end of movies. Even so, says Baum, for decades more, animal actors were basically used as living props. Over the past decade or so, Hollywood has become more progressive about animal rights.
It's likely improving, it's really a mystery, for the most part, where we're at. Oftentimes, things go wrong, and we end up hearing about it after the fact.
Movie producer Gavin Pallone agrees. More needs to be done to keep animals safe on sets.
I can't even remember a time where I didn't feel very sensitive about animals. I didn't have a lot of friends when I was growing up. My best friend was a cat. And then throughout my entire life, pets have been the other entities that I've been closest to.
He's a vegan. He thinks exotic animals shouldn't be used as actors. And here's the really interesting part. A movie he produced wound up on the wrong side of PETA earlier this year.
Bailey, 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 Bailey.
My name was Bailey, 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 Bailey.
A Dog's Purpose is about the bond between humans and dogs. PETA boycotted it after a video surfaced on TMZ showing a resistant dog being forced into water.
There was something that happened on the set, which was a dog was put under stress for between 35 and 40 seconds, and that shouldn't have happened.
Pallone says the video was edited to make the situation look worse than it was. He wasn't there when the incident happened, but he is upset that it happened. He sees it as a symptom of problems with the way animal oversight in Hollywood works. Even so, he doesn't agree with PETA's no animals on set standard.
The problem with that is you can't replace every animal with a digital animal.
He says the cost of a movie like A Dog's Purpose would have jumped from 20-some million to more than $100 million. And at that price, he says, it just wouldn't have been made.
If people at home and children start watching television and movies and they don't see any animals, then that disconnects them from animals.
But that worry is unlikely to temper PETA's mission. especially coming off a win like the end of the circus. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Coming up.
A lot of times people will avoid talking about boredom because it's kind of embarrassing. Nobody really wants to admit that they get bored.
Yeah, but first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 141 points on this Friday, 0.6%, closed at 20,804. NASDAQ up 28 points, about 0.4%, 6,083. S&P 500 rose 16 points, about 0.6%, 2381. For the week, the Dow off 0.4%, the NASDAQ down 0.6%, the S&P 500 slipped 0.4%. Thanks, Wednesday. We pointed out that the U.S. is the arms dealer to the world in the defense sector. Today rose ahead of President Trump's visit to Saudi Arabia. Lockheed Martin, in the headlines related to that trip, boosted itself 2% today. Guided missile manufacturer Raytheon shot up about 1.5%. Aerospace defense tech contractor Northrop Grumman up 1.2%. We mentioned freight and how it's getting more competitive with Uber in the mix, perhaps. FedEx delivered 0.3% today. UPS rose 0.2%. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note ticked up just a hair, 2.23%. You're listening to Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood.
We host a podcast called Make Me Smart.
And we want to know what you want to know
about business, technology, and culture.
Write to us at makemesmart@marketplace.org.
And check us out wherever you get your podcasts.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million-dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. How about a little escapism late of this Friday afternoon? You good with that? The new Alien movie and the new Guardians of the Galaxy film are going to top the box office this weekend, most likely. Both just the most recent examples of big tentpole productions that suck all the oxygen and the money, oh, by the way, out of the movie-making ecosystem. So with the summer film season nearly upon us, we've called Wesley Mars. He writes on movies and culture for the New York Times. Hey.
Hi, Kai.
Well, I want to have a little chat about summer box office approaching No, really? Is that a bad topic for you? Do you not like summer box office?
Listen, I'm open to talking about it. Let's talk about it. Let's do it.
All right. Okay. I want to know, are you looking at any good movies this summer or is it all going to be boring old tentpoles?
Listen, we're in tentpole city now. It's just purely these blockbusters. So there's very little room between these for anything that isn't something meant to proliferate unto eternity. some of these things I'm looking forward to. I've seen the trailer for the new Thor movie, and I find it extremely exciting.
But can we just have a non-superhero movie, please? Come on, man.
Well, you know what's funny is even the things that don't look like superhero movies wind up being, if not superhero movies or comic book movies, definitely franchises. Every studio really wants to have a franchise, which of course is the bad news for Warner Brothers in this King Arthur Legends of the Sword.
Well, you knew that was going to be bad going in, and yet they spent, I don't know, a gazillion dollars on it.
They spent $175 million on it.
And what did it make? My notes here say it took in $14.7 million at theaters last weekend.
Yeah, no, that is not a franchise amount of money. I think there's a lesson to be learned, at least for Warner Brothers, in what went wrong with this movie. I think that era is kind of Deadsville for things that aren't Game of Thrones.
Well, So I was about to jump on studios for never learning a lesson, but can you really fault them for seeing Game of Thrones on TV and saying, oh, yeah, we got to do that. Let's do something like that.
Yeah, but this isn't Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
This is basically an action movie premised upon something that you can't shoot or explode. It just feels out of sync with what people want to see, which is outer space and Michelle Rodriguez and Vin Diesel driving really fast.
Fate of the Furious, of course. Are we doomed then for the foreseeable? I feel like I've asked you this question so many times. We're doomed, aren't we? I'm not even going to ask it. I'm going to state it as a fact. We are doomed to this kind of movie for the foreseeable future.
Yeah. I mean, the funny thing about calling these seasonal situations is just kind of comical now. I mean, summer starts in February now.
Okay, but wait. So for all I was just railing against the big tent poles, then you get these gems, and I'm going to get some letters about this. I know it. You're going to get some gems like Moonlight, which you and I have talked about and which we loved. Also, I'm going to out myself here. La La Land. I loved La La Land.
That movie made $150 million.
Yeah, but come on.
How are you outing yourself?
Well, no, because here's why, right? I mean, look, people look at it and go, oh, come on, it's a stupid little music about Los Angeles. Who cares? This was back when it was first coming out, right? And I loved it.
No, listen, you are not going to get me to say anything bad about La La Land.
Right.
It is a good enough movie to not be worth pointing to as indicative of anything other than things that the movie should be doing more of,
exactly,
as far as I'm concerned.
That's what I'm saying. That was what I was saying.
But I think as a counterpoint, I would point to a movie like Snatched, right? Which is Amy Schumer and Goldie Hawn. But I think that's a movie that is nominally a comedy. It is basically an action movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it is officially not a franchise movie, right? I mean, it is just a big, dumb comedy.
You don't think there's Snatched 2 coming?
I don't think so. I don't think it made enough money. And I also think that Snatched 2. But it's not the movie is bad, and I think enough people who saw it this weekend probably agree with me.
You know what it's going to be? It's not actually going to be Snatched, the numeral 2. It's going to be Snatched, T-O-O.
Oh, boy.
Wesley Morris writes on pop culture and lots of stuff for the New York Times. He does a podcast, too. It's called Still Processing. Check it out. Wesley, thanks, man. We'll talk soon.
Thank you, Kai. Talk to you later.
I don't know what kind of week you had, but for those of us in the news business, boring is not a word that applies. But sometimes getting a little bored at work just happens. Mary Mann is the author of the new book, Yawn, Adventures in Boredom.
Boredom is this sort of irritated restlessness. A lot of times people will avoid talking about boredom because it's kind of embarrassing. Nobody really wants to admit that they get bored. I talked to a lot of friends about how they feel at work and was really surprised that so many of them are bored at work so often because they're all very, very busy. But they all find time to check Facebook, to check Instagram, to do whatever it is that they do when they want to get their minds off work that feels boring or feels sort of meaningless. There was this group of monks in the 4th century called the Desert Fathers, and what they were doing was living out alone in the desert with nothing, just praying and working, and they were so bored. The first written account of boredom comes from them. It's from this monk named Cassian who came to live with them. He describes this tedium or perturbation of the heart that induces such lassitude of body and craving for food as one might feel after hard toil. Finally, one gazes anxiously here and there and sighs that no brother of any description is to be seen approaching. And that sounds so much like an office to me, going to and from the break room, like grabbing a snack, grabbing a coffee. And sometimes that's just a thing you got to get through, those moments. And sometimes it is a sign that maybe you're not doing what you want to be doing.
Sometimes, huh? Mary Mann, whose new book is called Yawn, Adventures in Boredom. This final note on the way out today, in which it occurs to me that we never actually said up at the top of the show, by we, I mean I, by the way, never actually said up at the top of the show, what the New York Times, Russia, White House Comey scoop was this afternoon. The Times reports that in his meeting with the Russians in the Oval Office the other day, President Trump called the just-fired FBI Director James Comey, quote, a nut job. Which gets me to this. Merriam-Webster, the dictionary people whose social media feeds, by the way, are gold, they tweeted out today that lookups of nut job spiked 173,000% after the news broke. I should also say, looking at their webpage right now, trending on Merriam-Webster, the top five, nut job, collusion, counsel, witch hunt, and surety, all drawn straight from the headlines. All right, we have got to go. The Dow up 141 points today, about 0.6%. NASDAQ up 28 points, 0.4%. S&P 500 rose 16.6 tenths of 1%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Sitar Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. We are back on Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a good weekend, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.